The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about improvisation and the way in which a spirit of improvisation can really inhabit so many human endeavors. And not just those in which we talk quite overtly about improvisation, especially things like music or improvisational speaking. But the spirit of improvisation is at the heart of so many human endeavors. And in many respects, improvisation has a whole lot to do with the leaps of discovery which we make in, for instance, the sciences. Improvisation is also something that can be not only a creative tool, but perhaps a destructive tool, a tool that sows chaos and maybe disruption for no particularly good purpose. And sometimes disruption is exactly what we need, and improvisation can be part of that effort to shake us loose from long calcified assumptions about the world and how we should live or how the world operates. A book that touches on all of these matters and even more has just been published, and it's called Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Time of Trump. The book is by a very interesting man by the name of Randy Fertel. Randy Fertel is a writer and also a philanthropist whose efforts have done much to bolster the arts, education, environmental concerns, particularly in his native city of New Orleans. He has written a couple of other previous books, A Taste for Chaos, The Art of Literary Improvisation, and The Gorilla Man and the Empress of Steak, A New Orleans Family Memoir. Again, this latest book is titled Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Time of Trump, published by Spring Publications. Randy Fertel, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. I'm happy to be here. And happy for that introduction. You clearly read the book carefully.
I really did, and very much enjoyed it. And ahead of talking about the book, I hope you won't mind if we just probe for at least a couple of minutes into your own really interesting background, a background that you explore in your memoir that I really hope someday I can read, called The Gorilla Man and the Empress of Steak. A book title can't get much more intriguing than that. I happen to know what you're getting at, but none of our listeners do. Explain your parents and this intriguing title.
So I am the offspring of two iconic, famous or infamous New Orleanians. My mother was the Ruth of Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. She bought Chris Steakhouse in 1965 and created an empire, now the largest upscale restaurant in the world. My father, and they had divorced quickly, so a lot of New Orleanians didn't connect them, even though they know there were these two Fertels. They didn't know they had once been married. But my father was a bit of a kook. He independently wealthy, inherited money at too young an age, and didn't do much with his life. But he did run for mayor on the platform that the zoo needed a gorilla. The only plank in his platform, kind of like Trump's wall, and he loved gorillas, and he got 310 votes and went out and bought two baby gorillas and gave them to the zoo and announced he was the only mayoral candidate in history who had kept all his mayoral promises. So they're both beloved, but my book was called A Tell-All or A Fur-Tell-All for revealing their connection. Had a lot of fun with it. Delve into New Orleans history. They're interesting in this way. My mother comes from the mouth of the river, Happy Jack, Louisiana. And my father's family came from Rampart Street, where jazz was being born when his mother was born. His mother was born four blocks from Louis Armstrong and about a year apart. So they were very interesting people, and it's a very interesting wedding of two worlds, and it was fun exploring that.
I'm sure. You've just touched on something that I wanted to be sure to explore a bit, and that is how it's really no coincidence that somebody from the city of New Orleans has written a book about improvisation. And, of course, as I said at the outset, your book is about a whole lot more than just improvisation as it plays out in, for instance, jazz, or for that matter, in other kinds of music. But, of course, the fact that New Orleans is widely thought to be the birthplace of jazz means that there is a great deal of sense in somebody from New Orleans writing about and being curious about improvisation. And of course, if one really thinks about the city of New Orleans and sort of the crazy melting pot that it has been for most of its history, even beyond the matter of jazz, there's a way in which I should think a spirit of improvisation has a whole lot to do with the shaping of your city, your hometown, and the way its history has played out over the years.
Well, one way to look at that, one thing that I do with the city of New Orleans is I talk about the opposition between the Cartesian grid that was created in 1718 by Bienville and Iberville, and just beyond the ramparts of the city grid, this very rational X, Y axes grid. Just opposite the grid is Congo Square, which really is, it was called a square, but it was really a bunch of circles. It was a native marketplace that the enslaved people were allowed to gather on Sundays and in their song circles and dance circles and drum circles. And so there was this opposition just ingrained in the culture between the grid and circles. And of course the Frenchmen took the high ground and said, we're rational. You black folk, you aren't rational. Well, they're drumming, their bambula rhythms were embodied emotion. They carried the intuitive culture that they carried across the Middle Passage. And so this opposition is at the heart of improvisation, that improvisation is always a pushback against the reigning dominant rationality and logic and evidence-based science. Because there's more to life than X plus Y equals Z. There's more to life. Hmm. And improv comes along to remind us of that.
Right. And of course, through the course of your really interesting book, you explore a lot of the different ways in which we can kind of think of those two sides of our human nature, including something called hot cognition versus cold cognition, and so on. It plays out in so many interesting ways, and in some ways that are really fun, and in some ways that are perhaps a bit dangerous. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Randy Fertel about his new book, Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Time of Trump. I wonder if you would mind recounting to our listeners the way your book begins with an example of comic improv that really sounds like fun. And I don't remember now off the top of my head if this is something that springs out of the tradition of Second City, which you talk about in the opening to the book. But it's a great little skit.
Yeah, I found that quite late in the process of getting the book to press. And there's a documentary about Second City, I'm pretty sure. And there's a moment in it where it's a little skit on a Second City stage, and it's, you know, late 50s, so it's kind of the beatnik generation is the setting. And there are six or eight nicely dressed people, but, you know, hiply dressed people, and they're standing around or sitting maybe with a chair turned around, and they're all beating out a rhythm. And they aren't beating out the same rhythm. It's syncopated, but it's working well together. They've got something going, and they're having fun. And then there's this guy who kind of sneaks onto the stage, and he kind of out-hipsters the hipsters. He's got a goatee and a cigarette in his mouth and maybe a beret or something. But he's carrying a doctor's satchel, and he surreptitiously puts it on a chair, and he opens it up, and he pulls out a metronome, and he sets the metronome going, and the tick-tock, tick-tock goes against the syncopated rhythms that they put together, and they try to keep their syncopation going, but they're defeated by the metronome. And so for me, this was just a perfect metaphor for the way improv and the dominant rational, logical, science-based culture works. And the metronome itself is just a perfect metaphor for everything that improv is trying to object to.
That's a really interesting way to look at it. And of course, one other, I think, important matter to consider is the fact that syncopation, which by its very nature is when pulses, when beats sort of fall where we don't think they're going to, they don't fall with perfect and predictable regularity, that also implies that underneath it is some kind of steady pulse, because otherwise nothing is a surprise, because everything is a surprise. But if there is some sort of steady pulse, then when we deviate from it, then we get this wonderful thing called syncopation and the energy that comes from it. And in a sense, part of what your book is about is how we can't really live without one or the other. And the wonderful synergy that occurs between the two is kind of what makes it all go, what makes it all work.
Right. We need both. We need hot cognition and we need cold cognition. We need the Cartesian grid and we need the bamboula circles. I quote Winton's, my fellow New Orleanian, Winton Marsalis's Harvard lectures on music, where he talks about syncopation and how syncopation is a kind of offering that you snatch away. You know, you establish a beat, you offer that established beat, and then you snatch it away with a surprise. And, you know, the big picture I'm offering is that's how culture advances, by surprises, which hot cognition, responds to and makes something of. By the way, I keep thinking that you suggested that it seemed apropos that this book came out of a New Orleans seething brain. It's also true, you know, I've worked on this for 50 years, and when you work on something that long, you've got plenty of time to think about why the hell am I doing this? What on earth could have moved me to do this? And, you know, it goes back to my parents, because my mother was a math science whiz. She had a master's degree in physics, worked as a lab technician for the founding cardiologist in our culture, George Birch, at Tulane. Really sharp, really smart. And my father, who didn't finish college and who was a bit of a trickster, he was a gambler. Well, they were both gamblers. They got together because they both love horses. You know, it's like I'm trying to find the balance between those two, between the hyper-rational and the, well, we'll be kind and call it intuitive, instinctual response. I won't call it irrational. We'll call it non-rational. And that's the opposition at the heart of improv and its endless battle or dance with dominant culture.
I like that very much. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Randy Fertel, talking about his book, Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Time of Trump. And you talk, as we said towards the beginning, about the way in which a lot of us encounter improv, namely comedy improv, such as with Second City, which is located not too far from where I'm speaking to you, right down in Chicago. And you talk about how, in many respects, improv in recent years, in terms of kind of the creative sphere, has really surged in significance and popularity. And all kinds of things are springing from improv in a way that probably was not once the case, including in entire films that have largely sprung up out of endeavors of improvisation. And I, for one, have to confess, I hadn't really stopped to think about that, about the way in which improv is really surging in a way that I think a lot of us aren't taking the time to kind of fully appreciate.
Well, you know, improvisation is about something you've never seen before. It's the unforeseen. It's something impromptu that's never been done before. You're not following rules. And that starts, in a sense, there are many start dates, but if you look at the 20th century, Freud and Jung are basing their psychology on pre-association. They think they're going to get to your problems by getting you to pre-associate. Jazz musicians are in the 1890s, right at the same time, 1900, jazz musicians are improvising and pre-associating. Louis Armstrong creates the jazz solo, playing off the melody in surprising ways. And then method acting starts, and then rhythm and blues starts, and then rock and roll starts, and then all those airs to rock and roll, each one more spontaneous, rougher, more garage band, three-chord music that's meant to be rough, meant to be indecorous, meant to be in your face, meant to get the old folks to say, no, this is the Satan's music. So my point is that it can be argued that we live in the age of improv. Comedic improv, you know, takes the Chicago by storm. And then, you know, now there are comic improv clubs all over the country. I hear they're all over Europe. There are even English improv clubs in France. It's really a thing. And then that morphs into Hollywood, independent films first, and then mainstream films. Improv is all over the place. So if you were looking for the engine of global popular culture, which is something new under the sun, you know, there was the British had their empire upon which the sun never set, but they didn't have the internet to broadcast their culture. And now improv just dominates global popular culture. It is the heart and soul of the engine of global popular culture.
I wonder if I could get you to talk for a couple of minutes about something that you explore in the book, namely the creation of one of the most iconic films ever made, and that film, The Godfather, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. And although I have some acquaintance with the film, certainly have seen the film and love it, and actually a few years ago interviewed one of the biographers of Francis Ford Coppola, I don't remember knowing what you tell us about how this film, in a sense, took shape and how Francis Ford Coppola, in a sense, drew upon both hot cognition and cold cognition in order to ultimately create this amazing masterwork, which ended up having a bit of a spirit of improvisation at its heart. Explain the creation of The Godfather and the so-called Godfather notebook that came before, and why this particular story finds its way into your book about improvisation.
Well, so Francis had a theater background, and I'm not going to remember the language that they used, but when you do a play, you do a playbook. You take the script and you put it into a dream reading binder, and you make notes on it left and right, blocking, lighting, all the details that your cold cognition mind brings to bear to bring this thing to life. And so when he decided to do Mario Puzo's The Godfather, he took the novel apart, put it in a notebook, a spiral notebook, and made endless notes that were largely motivated by fear, because he had an Academy Award then for a great military film. I have terrible trouble with names. I'm blanking on that famous name. But he had an Academy Award, but he had, I think, two or three kind of mediocre films that he had directed. And so this was a major deal, and he was scared to death. And so he had this really rich document that he said later that he didn't need the script because everything that he wanted was in the notebook, and he could just go from the notebook. So in other words, it was a work of hot cognition, but it was motivated by the emotions that are at the heart of hot cognition, fear and anger. Well, fear, not anger. So they start filming, and the first shot is the famous shot where Marlon Brando is seated at his desk, and Amerigo Bonacera, wonderful name, America Goodnight is the character, and he's upset because his daughter has been raped by two white Anglos, and they didn't get justice. They got white man's justice, just to say they got off. And he's come for vengeance. And a bit of absolute serendipity, someone puts, we're not sure who, puts a cat on Marlon Brando's lap, and the cat starts purring, and Brando's voice, which is already a mumble, can't be heard. So when the lords of cold cognition, the management team, the studio sees these dailies, they say, "This is terrible. Get rid of that director. This isn't going to work out." So there's this big fight over that. But it all works out. It continues, and it's a series of serendipities. There are all kinds of wonderful improvisations that happen along the way. And what it boils down to is that it's a story of American conquest. It's like King Lear, about a man with three sons, one of which is meant to be his replacement, but he gets shot down in a crossfire, and his innocent son gets drawn into the business. And Michael is a trickster figure. Trickster is the ruling figure of improv. And that film ends with the baptism and murder of the five families. So the only film better than Godfather is Godfather 2. If only Godfather 3 had come up to it. But I had a lot of fun with it.
We're speaking with Randy Fertel about his book, Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Time of Trump. We are going to get very shortly to kind of the dark side of improv, hinted at in the subtitle of your book. But I want to talk about a couple of other things first. One of them is when you talk about the way in which improvisation, or at least something resembling improvisation, can be at the heart of some of our most important scientific discoveries. And this, of course, is also a wonderful example of a mixture of hot cognition and cold cognition, in which part of scientific exploration and discovery is about methodical, step-by-step process, being careful, being cautious, adhering to protocols, and so on. And yet, in many cases, then there will be this moment when something appears to be an incredible leap. And in many cases, our most important breakthroughs are not just about all the careful, methodical steps, but about the leap, sometimes sort of a leap of faith. Can you just talk for a moment about this interesting reality in the scientific sphere and what it was like for you to explore this in particular?
Well, so how many important scientific breakthroughs come from serendipity? The serendipity I just mentioned with regard to Godfather. Penicillin. He notices that the bread mold is killing the bacteria. And a whole, 20th century health increases manifold. Galileo gets a telescope, and he looks up at Jupiter, which is supposed to be in the firmament. That is, anything above the moon is supposed to be unchanging. And he looks up, and one night, the four moons that he can see with his telescope are in one configuration. The next night, they're in another configuration. So out of that comes the change from the heliocentric to the heliocentric universe, that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. Sun was. Here's an interesting example. A man, I think his name is Medvedev or something like that, a Russian nobleman who was a scientist, a mathematician. He was concerned with arranging the table of elements. It was a big issue in the 19th century. They had figured out atomic weights and all these things, but they couldn't arrange them in a rational way that showed their relationship to one another. One day he had he went about it in very rational means. He measured this and that, rearranged things. He couldn't make it work. So one day he's on his way to a wedding or something, but he misses his train and he's stuck for 3 days and he falls asleep and he dreams the periodic table of elements. He dreams it. And he wakes up and he lays it all out, and it has predictive force. You know, like uranium was thought to have 120 electrons or whatever it is. And according to this table of elements, no, it has 238. So this is science at its best, but it's generated by the intuition that is embedded in our dreams.
Hmm.
Cold cognition is the prefrontal lobe. Hot cognition is the brainstem and the amygdala, where our emotions live. And hot cognition has sometimes been called the brain supercomputer. It's if a tiger walks up, you're running before you even say, "Tiger, run." Your embodied emotions, your adrenaline is pumping before the word tiger gets to your mouth. And that's the power of hot cognition.
Hmm.
Ideally, hot and cold cognition would work together. Cold cognition would say it's a predictive function. It to save glucose, it doesn't look carefully at every detail in the present moment. It uses yesterday to predict what today is and what you should do next. So if the tiger walked up and you were a cold cognition kind of guy, you might say, "Tiger, there are no tigers around here. There was no tigers here yesterday. I'm going to stick." Well, your cold cognition gets the Darwin Award because that tiger is going to eat you. So it would be best if cold cognition and hot cognition communicated. Hot cognition would say, "No, that is a tiger. I think we better run." And cold cognition would say something like, to make a transition here. Cold cognition would say, if that guy says that his gut knows more than many brains, I think we better watch our pockets. If you got my transition to the Trump issue.
Hmm. Before we get to that, I also want to ask you about a chapter that comes later in the book that was a bit of a surprise to me. And this is a chapter mm-hmm. which the title of which makes mention of Facebook. It's chapter 10, The Rhetoric of Spontaneity in Your Facebook Feed. And this is really a chapter in which you talk about how the internet itself and social media in particular are now, in your words, a constant improvisational element in our lives, spontaneous but scripted, order out of disorder, an unruly routine. Tell us more in brief about the kind of things you explore in this particular chapter and how especially social media and platforms like Facebook tell us something about the nature of improvisation.
Well, let me go back to that first word of the chapter, the rhetoric of spontaneity. So the first paradox I dealt with in my work over the years was to realize that When we say we're just noodling, we're just improvising, we're just playing around, the suggestion is that it's just for fun. There's no purpose to it. Life may demand purposefulness, but we're taking a moment away from that. We're just having fun. Well, in fact, that's a persuasive device. Number one, it says, hey, if I can do this without logic and reason and evidence, why bother? And it also says, hey, trust me, I can do this. I got this. So it's a persuasive device. Now, the way social media works is it says, hey, this is just for fun. We're just putting people together. The more voices, the better. And so we're just going to create this little algorithm. We're going to use a little co-cognition to create a series of steps. And then we're going to put that into what engineers would call a black box. We're not really sure what happens in the black box, but all we're going to ask of this algorithm, the only task we're going to give it, the only purpose, is nothing political, nothing financial. We're just going to increase engagement. We're going to ask it to increase engagement. So it scrapes the internet in its black box, the algorithm does, using large language models now. And it soon learns that the quickest way to increase engagement, the most powerful way, is fear and anger by getting hot cognition aggravated. So the internet is a grand improvisation in that all the content comes from us. Nobody's in charge. And yet the algorithm is steering us. And the algorithm says that its only purpose is engagement, not monetization or politics. But it soon learns that if fear and anger are the most motivating forces to increase engagement, then next thing you know, you're getting genocide in Myanmar when the Muslims are attacked by the military, and it's put on Facebook, a lie is put on Facebook that a Muslim man had raped a Buddhist woman. And next thing you know, tens of thousands of people come out attacking the Muslims. Tens of thousands Muslims die. Millions retreat across the border, and the government asks Facebook, could you please take this down? Could you please take Facebook down? And they say, oh, no. You know, the more voices, the better. We don't have any political purpose. But finally, the government takes it in hand and takes Facebook down, and the genocide disappears overnight. So if you're wondering why right-wing conspiracies and white right-wing governments are on the increase around the world, it's because fear and anger are being served to us daily with our breakfast, coffee, and toast. And by the way, when the government took down Facebook after the genocide, Facebook finally responded to their, you know, this situation. They said, why has our engagement decreased so radically? So it's not pretty, and it's very scary. I performed a little experiment on myself by accident when I wrote this chapter. You know, all the ominous things that had been said about social media came home, and I thought, man, I got to get off Facebook. So I didn't quite get off. I lurked on it. I looked at friends' posts and stuff, but I stopped posting myself. And it was a relief. But then, you know, when you're selling a book, you have to rely on social media. So I started posting pictures of this event and that event. And I found myself re-addicted to those likes, because each of those likes, they call social media a casino in your pocket. Your iPhone is a casino in your pocket, because you're looking for that bump, that dopamine bump that you get when you get a like. Now, the historical irony here is that the man who invented the friends and like idea is a man named J.L. Moreno, who invented a theater of spontaneity in like 1914 in Austria. He took it to New York in the 20s. He believed that spontaneity could cure a lot of the ills of industrial society, the anomie, the alienation, the violence. And one of the things he invented to foster that improvement was a thing he called sociometry. So imagine, you know, your daughter is having trouble in kindergarten, so someone goes in and they draw a graph of how Catherine is relating to the people in the kindergarten, and then you can try to improve things by putting her in touch with the people, or she's not in touch with, something like that. Well, that sociometry, that graph, is exactly what Zuckerberg used to create his likes and friends buttons. And where Moreno thought that this was going to be the end of all the problems of industrial and post-industrial society, in fact, it just ratcheted them up. And that's what's going on in social media today. It's really frightening. And I worry because, you know, we need some legislation to rein this in. But social media giants have all the money and all the lobbyists. And we have a Congress that can't get anything done. So I really worry that, you know, and now with AI, it's just going to get worse.
You do have a chapter that is titled Improvisation's Dark Side. And this is a chapter in which you explore some of the ways in which improvisation can play, in a sense, a disruptive role in a more perhaps destructive way. Again, depending on sort of what your values happen to be and so on. And you explore a couple of different examples of this. One of them is a surge in what sometimes is called hookup sex or casual sex, in which people are seeking an experience that, in the words of someone you quote, is spontaneous but scripted, order out of disorder, an unruly routine, in which people are not trying to kind of carefully sow a meaningful relationship, but just wanting to just experience just a little bit of pleasure that really has nothing to do with the construct of a meaningful relationship with an arc and a purpose and so on. I had never stopped to think about how that kind of phenomenon could be thought of, in one way at least, as an exercise in improvisation, and an improvisation that might yield pleasure in the moment, but also a whole lot of problems.
Well, Oscar Wilde said that spontaneity was a meticulously prepared art, and Lisa Wade's treatment of hookup culture just blew me away. I stumbled on this book, and she talks about, you know, it's spontaneous but scripted, it's an unruly routine, and it re-engineers society. That was the kicker. So hookup culture, which we don't need to go into deeply, but it's this thing that happens on campuses today. It's driven by alcohol, so your inhibitions are lowered. And basically, young women dance together in the center of the room, all of them intoxicated. And the guys eye them. And there's a trigger where the woman invites a guy to come dance behind her. It's very sexualized. And the odd thing about it is that the decision to move from the dance floor to something more is it happens because of the woman, her face is away from the guy. She hasn't really seen him. What she's looking for is her friends and whether they give the thumbs up or thumbs down. So this is sex that emerges not because of some affinity, some feeling, but just because of the social scale, the social ladder. And the way Lisa Wade explains it, or maybe it's how I explain it, is, you know, every generation has to outdo their parents. And so, you know, the parents of these kids, maybe the offspring, I don't know. And I'll just put it this way. The parents of these kids say they're boomers, and they had pre-sex in the 60s. But then they settled down into marriages, into caring relationships, which, of course, statistically, many ended in divorce. So these hookup kids do their parents one better. They're going to have lots of sex like their parents, but they're not going to get trapped in this emotional entanglement in relationships. So Lisa Wade, a sociologist who studied this closely in classrooms with journals and whatnot, she's very concerned because there's a lot of depression on campus. And, of course, it's paralleled by the depressing effects of social media. And there's a lot of depression, there's a lot of suicide, and she's very concerned. I mean, you know, maybe relationships, long-term relationships, should pass on into the graveyard of history, but not caring, not intimacy, not vulnerability. That's not something we want to re-engineer out of our lives.
Randy Fertel is the author of Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Time of Trump. We did not have time to air the interview in its entirety today. If you seek out the podcast version of today's program, you can hear this interview unabridged, which will include some comments by the author about former President Donald Trump and the brilliant way in which Mr. Trump has utilized improvisation or the appearance of improvisation in his campaigns. The book is published by Spring Publications. And remember to seek out the podcast version of The Morning Show. Be sure to look for it under the proper title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we look forward to having with us Dr. Art Sear for his monthly visit to the program, offering his thoughts and analysis on recent events, including, of course, President Biden's decision to step down from the pursuit of a second term. That and more we will discuss tomorrow. And on Friday, out of the archives, four different interviews related to the Olympic Games. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Look for the archive of The Morning Show on our website, WGTD.org. Today's going to be partly cloudy, warm, and there's a 40% chance of intermittent rain with a high of 76 degrees. Mostly clear tonight, low of 60, sunny tomorrow, and a high of 79 degrees. And our temperatures will inch up from there to 81 on Friday, 83 on Saturday, to 87 on Sunday, 89 on Monday. And mostly sunny skies expected through the period. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.